Happy Thursday morning. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix along with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later on this hour, we'll talk about water concerns in Nogales. Plus, we'll go into the kitchen with Chris Bianco.
But first, more than a year out, the prospects for Arizona Senator Jeff Flake's reelection are of great interest and speculation. Three potential primary challengers have reportedly had meetings at the White House. Flake already has one GOP primary opponent, former state Senator Kelly Ward, who lost to John McCain in last year's Republican primary. And now Politico is reporting that a top donor to President Trump is giving $300,000 to a super PAC supporting Ward. Alex Eisenstadt wrote the article about that and joins me now. Good morning, Alex.
Hi there.
So how significant is this, both the amount and where it's going?
Well, it's significant in that the name of this donor, Bob Mercer, was really integral to Donald Trump's rise and his election as president. Bob Mercer is a reclusive hedge fund manager. He's someone who is very close to Steve Bannon. He's someone who's very close to Kellyanne Conway. And Donald Trump is someone who really trusts and respects Bob Mercer, to the extent that when last December, when after Trump was elected, he sort of went up to his Long Island. He went up to Mercer's Long Island mansion and kind of kissed his ring, so to speak, after his win. And so now Mercer is pumping in $300,000 into this pro-Kelly Ward super PAC. And that's significant because of the timing here, right? You have a situation where Jeff Flake has written a book in which he's very critical of the president, and he's really been critical of the president now for some time. And that's really annoyed and kind of angered Trump and other people in the White House.
On the issue of timing, there has been some talk that there might be another candidate or other candidates in general getting into this race, potentially some with the support and backing of President Trump. Does the timing of this donation from somebody with close ties to the president, does that preclude that in some way? Does that send a signal to maybe other potential challengers?
Well, it could. And what you have is a situation where there are two other people really looking closely at this race. One is the state treasurer, a guy by the name of Jeff DeWitt, who actually worked on the Trump campaign, is close to the president, speaks with the president. And then the other is the former Republican Party chairman in Arizona, a guy by the name of Robert Graham. And so the thing here is that if you have a really powerful Republican Party donor like Robert Mercer giving money to support Kelly Ward, you're right in that it could sort of discourage or dissuade other people like DeWitt or Robert Graham from potentially getting into this race. And so they're looking at this now, and they may need to take some of that into account.
Yeah, why did you get a sense of why Mr. Mercer decided now was the time to put this money into the super PAC as opposed to maybe waiting to see how the field ultimately shakes out?
Well, it's a good question, but we do know this. We know that last year, as you mentioned in your intro, that Mercer spent a pretty significant amount of money to support Kelly Ward. And we also know that a website, a prominent conservative website that Mercer funds, and that also happens to be very pro-Trump, Breitbart, was very supportive of Ward when she unsuccessfully challenged McCain. And so with Ward already running against Flake, perhaps Mercer decided that the time was right to just give some money right now. Perhaps he wanted to keep out other potential Flake primary challengers. Or perhaps he felt that the timing was just that now was the time, with Flake out there conducting this national media tour in which he's hawking his new book, in which is really in some ways an anti-Trump manifesto. Perhaps Mercer just felt like now was the time was right to make a move.
Is there any evidence to suggest that this donation may have been done with the knowledge and or support of anybody inside the White House?
Well, and that I have not been able to fully confirm that or report that out. But what we do know is that Trump is keeping very close tabs on this race. And what we also know is that other people in the White House, including Steve Bannon and others, are keeping close tabs on this race. One anecdote that I heard about, this happened a few weeks ago, was that the state party chairman of Arizona, a guy by the name of Jonathan Lyons, was in the Oval Office with some other state party chairs from other states to talk about the political landscape generally. And Donald Trump was in the meeting, and Trump actually pointedly asked Lines for an update on the Flake race. And what I think this that anecdote really illustrates is the fact that the president of the United States is keeping a close eye on what is happening to Jeff Flake's race back at home, and he's taking a real interest in it. Though Trump has not explicitly said that he would necessarily back any of these potential primary challengers to him.
That's Politico's Alex Eisenstadt. Alex, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for your time. Thank you.
Last month, Governor Doug Ducey declared a state of emergency in response to damage to a sewage pipeline near Nogales at Arizona's southern border. Huge monsoon storms in Santa Cruz County caused flooding and breached the International Outfall Interceptor, a pipeline that brings sewage from Sonora, Mexico, to a wastewater treatment plant about 10 miles north of the U.S.-Mexico border. That development made the introduction of the Nogales Wastewater Fairness Act in the House and Senate very timely. And with me to explain more about the situation in Nogales is Paulina Pineda, reporter for the Nogales International. Paulina, what does the International Outfall Interceptor do, and how much water does it carry?
It carries 14 million gallons of raw sewage and runoff each day from Nogales, Sonora, and Nogales, Arizona, northward to a treatment plant in Rio Rico. And the treatment plant is a little bit more than a mile north of where the breach is. The line itself runs underneath the Nogales Wash in Nogales, and then it goes into what's called Potrero Creek, which feeds into the Santa Cruz River. The maintenance of the sewer line is the shared responsibility of the city of Nogales and the U.S. section of the International Boundary and Water Commission, or IBWC, and it's the result of an arrangement dating back to 1953. It's aged, and it hasn't been properly maintained, so that's led to a lot of the problems we're seeing today.
And some of these problems sound really daunting when people hear about sewage and the fact that, boy, is the water safe or not? Maintenance almost seems like an oxymoron. I mean, have there been concerns about maintenance for a while?
There have been concerns about maintenance for a while, and the city of Nogales is actually embroiled in a lawsuit right now with IBWC to determine who's responsible for maintaining and operating the sewer line. The city says it's charged an unfair amount since it only contributes a very small portion of the sewage that is treated at the treatment plant. So I know back in 2000 and 2008, the city and county also had to declare a state of emergency after a breach in the line, but I don't think there's ever been an incident of this magnitude.
There has been legislation introduced known as the Nogales Wastewater Fairness Act, and it has some pretty heavyweights behind it. It has both Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake involved in it. Can you give us some background on what that would entail if it were to go through?
So the Nogales Wastewater Fairness Act would make the city responsible for a proportion of the operating costs of the line and the sewer treatment plant based on the average daily volume of wastewater originating from the city sewer system. The deputy city manager at the time of the breach said in the month of June, I believe, the city only contributed 9% of the sewage that was treated at the plant compared to 91% coming from Mexico. And yet they're supposed to pay 23% of the plant's more than $5 million annual costs until the city either repairs or replaces the line, which there is a design plan for repairs to the line, but it's going to cost $40 million or so, which is not in the city's budget. The Fairness Act would free the city of any financial obligation for repairing and upgrading the International Outfall Interceptor, and it would place that responsibility on the IBWC.
For residents, is it really worrisome day after day? Is it even worse than those of us here would have perceived, or is it something people have kind of grown to live with?
That's a tough question. One of my colleagues actually went out to Rio Rico, and she spoke to kind of did man on the street interviews, and a lot of people weren't even aware of the break. And I mean, we're not the only people who have been reporting on it. This has been in the news for weeks now. And so I think people are concerned about wells. They said this officials said the city's water line or water system and any municipal systems further north on the Santa Cruz River aren't being affected. But people with wells around the wash are concerned that their wells might have been contaminated. But because of failures in the system in Nogales, Sonora, there is usually wastewater being dumped into the wash. So the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality has declared this portion of the wash in the Santa Cruz River as an impaired area. It typically has higher levels of contaminants that exceed the state standards. People are concerned, and we see it, you know, voiced on social media and in comments and replies to our stories that we've been running. But at the same time, I think it is something that people, maybe they're not necessarily accustomed to it, but they're not surprised.
Paulina Pineda is a reporter for the Nogales International in Southern Arizona.
It's the show. Good morning. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein and John Hockenberry at our partner, The Takeaway. The stock market seems a little like Olympic runner Usain Bolt.
Bolt stretching out now. He's coming after him. He's immortal now. Usain's done it.
Everybody is not an Olympic runner, though. The Dow had 9 straight days of record highs until this past Tuesday, and the overwhelming majority of income gains have gone to the ultra-rich in recent decades.
Income gains for the middle class have stayed relatively stagnant since 1980, growing by less than half of the top 10%, even as unemployment in July matched a 16-year low touched in May. In 2015, Sir Angus Deaton, a Princeton-based economist who won the Nobel Prize that same year, published a paper with his colleague and his wife Anne Case that found the mortality rates of white men and women in the U.S. between 1999 and 2013 were increasing, reversing decades of progress that no other rich country experienced. White privilege, among the most durable, safest bets in the U.S. economy, was apparently evaporating in men and women without a high school degree, aged 45 to 54, particularly among people with a deterioration in economic and social well-being. They were just dying by drugs, alcohol, and suicide. Deaths of despair, Deaton called them. I asked Sir Angus Deaton how overall economic success generates, of all things, despair.
Inequality is often a byproduct of progress, and it has been historically. And we don't want to choke off the progress that produces that sort of inequality. But inequality is very, very dangerous, too. But I don't think it's really very helpful to have an anti-inequality strategy as opposed to having a strategy that tries to mitigate the negative effects of inequality.
Would you describe the turning point that politicians often talk about, that the current voting generation, to use the United States as an example, does not believe it will be better off than its parents were? Do you believe Right. that milestone is very, very significant of a turning point, either in a country or an economy?
Yes, I think that has been important. And I think some of the really bad things we're seeing in the United States now, like the epidemic of deaths of despair that Anne Case and I have been talking about, we think that's very much associated with the phenomenon you talk about. That if you were born when I was born, immediately after the Second World War, more than 90% were better off than their parents quite early in their lives. And then if you go 20 years later, that's not true anymore. So it's not just the current generation. I mean, it's people in their 40s and 50s now whose lives have just not panned out the way that they could reasonably have hoped for when they started.
How do you reconcile the, and you describe the deaths of despair, but yet the, you know, stock market is setting records every single day. How do you reconcile those things?
You know, I don't think people always understand about the stock market. The stock market is the value of capital. Or it's what the stock market thinks the capital stock, what companies are worth. So if companies get better at squeezing labor, at reducing wages, which is what we're looking at when you think of people not being as well off as their parents, that will make the stock market go up. And one of the things that's been happening in the U.S. and in other European countries is that the share of capital in national income has been going up. And that's another reason that the stock market is going up. So it's sort of like, you know, if you can replace your workers by cheaper workers from China, that's going to make the stock market go up. It's not good for American workers, but it sure is good for the stock market.
I'm wondering if you believe that the signs of prosperity for people in the middle class are fundamentally disconnected from the way people are feeling about prosperity and their future and the way their lives are panning out, and that's dangerous.
I think it is dangerous, but I think people who are feeling that they've been badly done by actually have been badly done by. You know, there's been progress for some and not so much progress for a lot of other people. And I think the people who are dying and the people who are really upset are people who really have been left behind and have not shared in the progress.
So then what does it mean for America to be great again from the perspective of an economist?
Well, I think what it needs is for that growth to be better shared, and that we've got to have policies that help wage growth among people who are not so very well educated, who are not part of the elite. It can't be all globalization or technical change, because globalization and technical change are happening to all the rich countries. And yet the bad things that have happened in America haven't happened in Britain or Germany to anything like the same extent.
Did you expect when you got into economics, studying and then becoming the Nobel Prize winning economist that you are, that you'd be looking at things like the opioid crisis as a key economic indicator?
Of course not. When I went into economics in 1969, I wouldn't have known what I had the vaguest idea what an opioid was. On the other hand, I think like many economists, certainly those of us who grew up in Britain, we entered economics because we were interested in human welfare, human well-being. And so I don't think looking at these deaths of despair or seeing how people are doing is conceptually very different from the sort of things that I started out doing. So I sort of think of it more or less as a piece, though it was sort of amusing when I got the Nobel Prize and got the famous phone call. They had a story of my intellectual life, which is much more coherent than anything I'd ever worked out. The version I'm telling you now is sort of courtesy of them.
Well, it's nice to have the Nobel Committee write your resume, that's for sure, if you ever need a job.
I'd recommend it.
Yeah, definitely recommend it. Sir Angus Deaton is the 2015 Nobel Prize winning economist and the winner of the 2017 Franklin Founder Award. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, John. A real pleasure.
And that's John Hockenberry at our partner, The Takeaway.
Vladimir Putin has been president of Russia for nearly two decades, and his reputation in America has taken center stage since the 2016 election.
The holiday photo call. Every leader does one. No one else does them. Shirt off, fish in hand. Welcome to Vladimir Putin's summer break in Siberia.
President Putin there playing hockey, dressed up as he always does, whether he's doing judo or horseback riding.
Putin is the law, and members of his inner circle can operate with impunity.
What does he want? And is he really the most powerful man in the world?
But while we're all following the investigation into ties between President Trump and Putin, it's important to remember the relationship between our two countries will long outlast these two men.
That's why Russia scholar and government professor at Wesleyan University, Peter Rutland, recently wrote about the impending question in Russia. What will happen to the country after Putin? And Lauren, you spoke with Rutland more about this, but remind us first, how has Putin stayed in power for so long?
Right. Well, Putin first became president in 1999, and even though the Russian constitution requires that he step down after two consecutive terms, he got around that by moving sideways, becoming prime minister while his protege became president. Then in 2012, he decided to go back to the presidency, and by 2024, the country will certainly be thinking about his successor. But Rutland writes that there is a lot at stake in that transition for Russia and for the rest of the world. I spoke with him more about this via Skype, and I asked him about this larger-than-life persona that Putin has to much of the world. He can seem like an absolute ruler of Russia, but he's not.
Yes, he's certainly a larger-than-life figure with tremendous charisma and authority, both inside the country and on a global scale. But that being said, it's true that inside the country, he is not a personal dictator. He doesn't have unquestioned authority. He's not a Saddam Hussein. He's not a Stalin. He's more of a broker of rival interests.
He has, though, been in power for 17 years, and he says he's not sure he's going to leave the presidency anytime soon. So how has he managed to do that?
Well, he's a very skillful politician, and he's been able to work both with the public and build trust among the ordinary Russians and with the elites. And he's managed to satisfy the interests and needs of all of these rival interests. elites. And he's also been very skillful in making sure that any possible rivals to his power don't stick around very long.
Right. I want to take a quick step back and talk about a little bit of the background on this. Can you describe for us what Russia was like before Putin took power?
Well, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, Boris Yeltsin was the president, and he concentrated a lot of power in the hands of the presidency. But he was old, he was sick, and he was not able to manage the country. And the country was in a deep economic crisis, and the central government effectively collapsed. So when he nominated Vladimir Putin as his successor as president, Putin took over an institution that had potentially great strengths in the presidency, but hadn't exercised effective authority. And he was able to turn it around and turn the central government into a very powerful instrument for a ruling Russia.
You mentioned that the Russian people appear to be overwhelmingly in favor of Putin. Are they really supportive of him? I mean, I know that the press isn't quite free there.
The press is not at all free, really. The internet is still pretty free in Russia, but the TV, which is the main source of news for most people, is very tightly controlled. And the press is also pretty well controlled. So, yeah, a lot of the public support for Putin is manufactured by the Kremlin. There's no question about that. However, his actions have generally been seen as very successful in stabilizing the economy, in restoring Russia's prestige as a great power. So I think the evidence does suggest that most of the support for Putin is really genuine. Because the problem is you can't beat something with nothing. And one reason why people continue to support Putin is that they don't see any realistic alternatives.
Right. So then the question becomes, we're looking at another election here. Putin looks like he will win. And the question is, if his reign of power, so to speak, does end sometime soon here, whether it's in several more years or now, what would happen to Russia?
Well, there's a very wide range of opinion about that, because Russians experienced the trauma of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, which kind of came relatively out of the blue, and that was very traumatic for the society in general and for individuals, and they're scared of repeating that. So they're afraid if Putin goes, all hell will break loose. On the other hand, you can argue that, well, Russia has become more stable than it was in the 1990s. Putin has created some new institutions. He's created trust among the elites, finally. And so you can imagine, I think, a smooth transition of power where Putin nominates a successor, just as Yeltsin nominated him, and that new guy is able to manage the country just as effectively as Putin has. I mean, Putin is a smart guy, but he's not unique. There are plenty of other capable, strong figures in the Russian leadership who could grow into the role which he has created.
In your opinion, after spending so many years in Russia and studying it for so long, what do you think the best case scenario is for a post-Putin Russia?
Well, you know, in the West, what we'd all like to see is a democratic Russia. We'd like to see competitive elections and free press. And in the long run, that seems to be what produces the most stable political environment. Is that realistic for Russia? I'm afraid not. I mean, you can't rule it out because they did become fairly democratic in the 1990s. But I don't see it in the immediate future. What I would most likely see is a kind of Putin clone, somebody who will continue to run the system in the same way that Putin has run the system, which is a very authoritarian hand on the tiller of the state. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily bad for the West, because at least it means Russia is predictable, and hopefully we can persuade them not to be so aggressive in their foreign policy.
Peter Rutland is a professor of government at Wesleyan University, and he also writes the Nationalism Watch blog. Peter, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Angelica. I am over here on bus duty at Herrera.
Okay, I'll meet you on the bus.
Every school year is different, but the first week is always the roughest.
Alvarez, please come to the office.
And then we have the little guys, our little kindergartners. It's a scary world for them right now. They're coming into the new school.
Nine. How many kids do we have for the bus?
Nine!
Awesome.
See, what's funny is that I actually came to this school when I was younger, and I do have some of the teachers that work here that were my teachers, so that was a little awkward at the beginning. But it puts a lot more into perspective. The kids, they're just being kids right now. They don't know it all. Make sure we lock up. And that's how my day goes after school.
That's Angelica Marquez on bus duty at Herrera Elementary School in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, please let us know about it. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Mark, you know, I think everybody loves pizza, even me who tries to keep his calories low.
I know, you are like the healthiest eater on earth, but I do know that your love of bread does extend to pizza.
Oh, that's because I've got to go deep dish all the way. What do you, now, as an Easterner, original
thin crust.
Easterner?
Got to be thin crust. You got the big, like the greasy, floppy New York slice, or just the really thin thin crust New Haven pizza. Those are the best.
And you mix meat and veggies as toppings?
Sure, why not?
I sure do as well. Now, if you're a pizza lover in Phoenix, you probably already know about Chef Chris Bianco. He has a few restaurants in the area, and food critics have hailed his pizza as some of the best in the country. And he's finally put his years of experience in the kitchen into a cookbook. It's called Bianco, Pizza, Pasta, and Other Food I Like.
Let's do it. Well, welcome to our little kitchen.
When I stepped into his kitchen at Trotto, I thought, naturally, he'd whip up a recipe from his cookbook.
I don't know if it's in the book. I don't think so. I don't think it is. I mean,
what actually
really
happened is what you might call kitchen improv.
Well, the recipe, as most things in our restaurants, make themselves. We get really beautiful things that farmers bring us, and we try not to screw them up. We just got delivered these beautiful little shishito peppers. They're little peppers, and they're kind of crazy because you'll eat one and they're kind of sweet. Others are slightly spicy. Get a hot pan, a little bit of extra virgin olive oil. All we're gonna do is we're gonna smack this little. I mean that in a loving way, a little garlic clove. All we're trying to do is warm them. We're gonna warm them. This is a little bit of Malvern sea salt. Then I'm gonna put a pinch of it on. We're gonna put a few chunks of black pepper. You can take them as far as you want. And then when we plate it, it's going to be done in like mere seconds. We're just going to plate it some aioli. So this is kind of like a garlic mayonnaise, basically, that we make. Grab it with the spoon. Really beautiful. It looks like just a cornucopia of Christmas in the middle of a hot desert summer. We can have this plate of shishitos keep us company.
As we talked over the plate of peppers, it became clear that Bianco is just not a by-the-book kind of guy. He very much goes with what feels right at the time. And in the process of writing this cookbook, he says he wondered whether he'd even do it, because he worries cookbooks can make people think there's only one right way, and that can scare some people away from cooking.
This book was really one to say, how do you start the conversation? And I really think it will disappoint some people that know me that really believe that I was going to give them this cliff notes of this thing that they can make this perfect thing when on my children's life, the secret is there's no secret. You know, there's a meatball recipe from my mom that people ask me about my whole life. It is eerily similar to many, many meatball recipes out there. They're not that different. But in the assembly of it or in the execution of it, I think what's really cool about it or the opportunity is that my house will smell like your house. It smelled like my grandmother's house and maybe her grandmother's house. So it's really linked us into some type of unconscious aromatherapy in a way.
Is there a special kind of love or touch, though, that the average person can or cannot get from a standard cookbook? And is that why, even you talk about observations, is that sort of an important element to it, where it's, this is what I'm thinking about this. It isn't just a list of ingredients or whatever.
Some of these are less recipes and more just observations. You know, I hope that we make you turn the box around, the cereal box, or, you know, at the table, because that's what I did as a kid. I want to know what was in my post-ODs or whatever. And I was fascinated by small print and transparency.
In the book, and when you hear Chef Bianco speak, you might find more attention given to the ingredients themselves than the end result sometimes. He describes fresh mozzarella as a, quote, harnessed glass of milk, and talks about how the bread of a sandwich should be a, quote, cradle for the ingredients. And his passion for every part of food led to years of 18-hour days in the kitchen. In recent years, Bianco says he's taken a little step back and focused more attention on passing along his knowledge to others.
If you believe you can play your game with the same position your whole life, I believe we might be kidding ourselves. When we're younger, we think it's about, you know, pushing or pulling something, using our physicality to find our point of relevance. And I think the older I got, like, you know, people always saw me in front of the oven, you know, every day. And, you know, it was a 17-year period. I think I missed four shifts because I was sick. And what I realized is, first of all, it's a horrible recipe for your own life. You know, I mean, all this balance that I searched for in when I made you dinner, that I didn't have that in my life. And I still get in the oven, in the kitchen. I love to cook, but I can't do it 18 hours a day like I used to. And it is a younger person's game at that part. And thankfully for me, I have strong backs and arms and eyes that can see tickets clearly without squinting, and are at the point of execution that becomes a pivotal part of a restaurant business.
Okay, so this is a two-parter. One, why is pizza so unbelievably popular? And do you ever feel, even with the masterful nature of your pizza, do you ever feel like just picking up just a big old greasy slice?
I mean, yes, I do. I was just in New York, and people were asking about, oh, the best pizza in New York, what is it? And it might be a fuzzy Bobby Darin from a less than perfect jukebox, a slice that maybe is humble but good on a piece of wax paper, that the temperature of it is just hot enough that you know it's somebody looked after for you, but not how it's going to burn your hand. On the pizza side, I think what makes it so popular is in many places, especially in, you know, in New York where I grew up, it was our first food we ate away from home. You know, maybe it was after Little League or Boy Scouts or Brownies. You know, I can remember my grandfather was a New York City fireman. When we go up there in the summer, I usually spend 2 weeks, and I remember that he wasn't the biggest conversationalist, especially with an 11, 12-year-old, but going down to drive down to get a pizza, a cheese pizza with sausage, and have it sit on my knees in the station wagon during the 11-minute drive home, we had a common denominator.
Well, Chris Bianco, thanks so much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Chef Chris Bianco. His cookbook is out now. We've got a recipe for you. This one, actually from the book. It's on our website, theshow.kjzz.org.
Good morning. This is The Show on 91.5 KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Later this hour, a new report shows minority students in Arizona are punished more often than their white classmates and helping deaf concertgoers enjoy the shows.
But first, earlier this week, President Trump had strong words about the opioid epidemic in the U.S. He emphasized increasing law enforcement and making the southern border more secure to allow fewer illegal drugs to get into the country. But despite his Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis recommending the declaration of a public health emergency, the president did not take that step. How significant is that, and could it cause greater problems? With me to talk about that are James Hodge, professor of public health law and ethics at ASU, and Sarah Ngo, a recent ASU graduate. James, let me start with you. What are the biggest concerns about the president not declaring a public health emergency and instead emphasizing this law and order approach?
It's the wrong tack to suggest we're going to crack down on this opiate epidemic that we've dealt with. This is a legitimate, significant public health emergency nationally and here in Arizona, thus the declaration of emergency in our state. Mm-hmm. But what and how the president, through his commission designed to combat these specific issues, has really taken a tone of potential crackdown type of approach. It's the wrong approach, Steve, and it's the one for which we're here to correct in regards to how we classify this as a public health emergency. And you saw the president at least and Secretary Tom Price from HHS suggest it is an emergency of public health implications. We need to take a public health approach to it.
Sarah, this is not a secret now. We're hearing more and more about the opioid epidemic all across the country, whether it's the Midwest or Arizona. It appears that based on what you and James have looked into, that the problem is not getting any better.
No, this is in fact the deadliest drug epidemic in American history generally. This is not an urban problem, a rural problem. This is an American problem. There is no age too young or too old. there are 4 out of 10 Americans who know someone who is addicted to opiates, and I would estimate 9 out of 10 who know someone who has used opiates. So people are aware of this problem since 1999. Almost 600,000 people have died of overdose of opiates. So I don't think this is an awareness issue, but perhaps more of a treatment options or other problem.
One of the things we're really starting to observe, we're into second and third waves of where the trajectory of this particular epidemic's going. What started as a pain management epidemic in relation to significant overprescribing of, you know, prescription drugs that can be used safely has now morphed into a significant almost retraction of some of those policies, leading to more illicit drug use and greater numbers of deaths nationally and in Arizona related to illicit opiates like heroin, fentanyl, and other things of that nature.
Yes. In fact, in Arizona since 2012, heroin overdoses tripled. So we're seeing a huge problem with that in Arizona. We've seen 6,000 deaths in the last decade just here. That's over 2 a day.
And I think that's what led Governor Ducey to declare the public health emergency in our state, like 5 other states and multiple tribal governments. Mm-hmm. Nationally, Steve, it's time. This is a public health emergency of unquestioned proportions.
Is there a perception then that addicts are, to use a term the president has used in the past, losers? Are people being frankly more brutal on some than others?
The blame game is always there underlying any of these types of issues. Mm-hmm. Look back on tobacco 30 years ago, mm-hmm. the blame game that related to how we need as a country to stop tobacco use, and we've made a lot of strides there. But Steve, not from the perspective of blaming those who are directly in the path of these very serious addictive drugs through which doctors are prescribing them, of which a great proportion of people that get on pain management drugs can't get off. And then when they're forced to get off because of prescribing practices that are restricted, they do turn to illicit substances almost out of need. So one of the things that I've really tried to recast and rethink in my mind in relation to how we've studied this, Steve, is so critical. The moment you start blaming victims of any epidemic, whether it's from Ebola or Zika or opioids, you're in the wrong public health arena. That is not the game they're playing from a public health perspective. The tactics won't work. We've got to take a much stronger public health approach designed to improve societal conditions for people to make change and to improve in regards to their health status.
Implications of a public health emergency being declared. What would that send into effect?
Okay, there's just so many angles to what would have been possible with an emergency declaration. And even Secretary Price admitted in his briefing the other day, this is on the table still, but we're just not quite prepared to do it. I don't know what other evidence is needed. Because if you were to declare a national emergency from a presidential perspective or through Secretary Price, he's got the authority to do that independently. You're talking about infusion of new resources. You're talking about waiver of specific legal restrictions that are stopping efficacious, well-known interventions that can make a difference in people's lives right now. You're talking about the opportunity to implement specific measures that are about non-paternalistic interventions, better training for healthcare workers, more naloxone for EMT officials, better secured protections for law enforcement trying to deal with this problem on the streets. Mm-hmm. These are all possible and effectuated through emergency declaration. Absent that, we'll be waiting for these interventions in too many jurisdictions across the country. We'll be waiting and waiting, and along the way, people will be dying.
Mm-hmm. As recommended by the commission, there should be naloxone for all law enforcement officers. And in Arizona, we've seen extreme success with that. So in the last 6 weeks, or from June 15th to August 3rd, there were 1,400 possible overdoses. There were 1,000 instances of naloxone being used by law enforcement officials and emergency medical personnel in saving lives. And only 15% of these overdoses were fatal, which is still way too much. But we've seen a little over 1,000 naloxone treatments distributed to the public. This is something that has proven to be effective. This is the antidote.
How much worse can this problem get if the public health emergency happens but doesn't happen for 1 month, 3 months, 6 months?
It has no limit. There are so many projected deaths. In 2015, kids aged 12 to 17, there were almost 300,000 who are misusing opioids for non-medical purposes, and over 100,000 of these kids were addicted to it. So I don't see an end to this, especially with last year in Arizona, 800 people died of opiate overdose. And so in the next couple months, with more than 2 Arizonians dying every day, the numbers just add up too quickly.
Sarah Noe is a recent ASU graduate, and James Hodge is professor of public health law and ethics at ASU. We've been talking about the opioid epidemic and the potential impact of a public health emergency declaration.
More than 48% of Arizonans have some kind of post-secondary degree. That's higher than the national average. But the rate for the Phoenix metro area is lower than that average. Those are some of the findings of a new report from the Lumina Foundation. With me to talk about it is Jamie Marisotis, the Lumina Foundation's president. And Jamie, to what do you attribute Arizona's numbers?
Arizona is slightly above the national attainment rate at 48.6%, and I think that's generally good. But there are big disparities in the state by region and by race and ethnicity. And I think that's part of the challenge for the state is that those differences can actually slow progress on increasing success for the learners and therefore success for the state. So, for example, the Phoenix metro area is below the national average at only about 38.7%. And so there's a significant gap for people in the largest area of the state in terms of being able to achieve greater success. And then if you look at the differences by race and ethnicity, we see attainment rates in the state for African Americans, Latinos, and American Indians at close to half that of what it is for whites and Asian Americans. So those equity gaps we think are very important because they represent the fastest growing populations.
I was curious about the geographical rates because the three metro areas that have the state's public universities are generally higher than the rest of the state. But as you say, the Phoenix metro area's post-secondary attainment rate is lower than the national average and, in fact, lower than a lot of the neighboring metro areas. How concerning should that be?
I think that for a community like Phoenix, it's going to be very important to focus on increasing educational attainment as a core strategy that involves a coalition of stakeholders, not just the civic leaders or the political leaders, but also business leaders and educational leaders.
Now, in your report, you break down post-secondary attainment into four categories. There's a certificate, an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, and a graduate or professional degree. And when it comes to bachelor's degrees, the state's rate was 18%. And that's actually lower than the percentage of Arizonans who only have a high school degree. I'm wondering, when you look at the types of post-secondary attainment that Arizonans have, do those certificates and degrees match the kinds of jobs that the state and sort of the economy as a whole are producing?
Well, there's a whole continuum of jobs that are being created today in our country and certainly in a state like Arizona, and the vast majority of them require some learning beyond high school. It might be a certificate or associate degree, or it might be a bachelor's degree or higher. We know from the last recession that the vast majority of the jobs that were created post-recession after 2011 went to people who had bachelor's degrees or higher. So there's still very high demand for people with bachelor's degrees. At the same time, when we look at the projections of the changing nature of work, we're seeing more opportunities for people with associate's degrees, with certificates and other credentials. And so I think it's important to focus on all post-high school learning, but we continue to think that for the foreseeable future, bachelor's degrees are still the gold standard that the majority of people should aim at.
When you look at these numbers, do they take into account both Arizonans who grew up here and went to school here and sort of went through the school system here, as well as people who have moved here maybe after they have finished their education? In other words, is it possible that some percentage of the almost 49% of Arizonans who have some kind of post-secondary attainment, is it possible that they got it somewhere else and then moved here afterwards for work or for some other reason?
So these data are population measures, so they represent the people who are there now. And so some of the 48.6% of Arizonans with a post-secondary credential will have come from other states. And several states, many people talk about Colorado being the top example in the country, actually have a very high percentage of the people who live there coming from out of state. So for a state like Arizona, it's important to continue to grow from within, recruiting people who have skills, knowledge, ability with these credentials is valuable, but growing the success of people who grow up and stay in Arizona is a very important strategy for the state. That's the ticket to long-term success.
So I guess what is your sort of bottom line takeaway from this for Arizona? It sounds like you're saying that Arizona's in, you know, decent shape, but you know, it's not the kind of thing where Arizona should rest on its laurels on this. I mean, how would you describe the bottom line on this?
Arizona is making good progress on increasing educational attainment after high school, but it isn't fast enough to meet the state's needs. That means that more focus needs to be placed on accelerating the progress that we've seen in recent years to meet the state's workforce needs, to ensure that more people get into and through these post-secondary learning programs to help not just those individuals, but everyone in the state prosper.
Jamie Marisotis is president of the Lumina Foundation. Jamie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Earlier this week on the show, Arizona Republic columnist Lori Roberts told us why she doesn't think the city of Phoenix is getting a good deal in its sale of the downtown Sheraton Hotel. In particular, she thinks the city is attempting to put a positive spin on a money loser, saying the private buyer has actually lowered its bid.
And now they've come back with an offer not $300 million, but $255 million, which sort of tells me that this hotel that taxpayers built for $355 million, wasn't worth $355 million, wasn't even worth $300 million. Now we find out that they're willing to buy it for $200 million on the condition that they get a $97 million break in property taxes.
David Kreider, president of Downtown Phoenix, Inc., heard our conversation and wanted the chance to clarify some details. I began by asking why the city of Phoenix got into the hotel business in the first place a decade ago.
Strong urban downtowns that contribute to the economic vitality of their regions all have very robust hospitality and convention activity that put a lot of people out on the street. Phoenix had a very, very weak downtown hospitality and convention market. There were two hotels capable of hosting conventions and a very undersized convention center. So I think the city and downtown community and the state of Arizona made a very bold decision to invest in what is really economic development infrastructure, a rebuild of the convention center and the construction of the Sheraton Hotel. So now you fast forward 8 or 9 years, and now we have this very robust and growing downtown hotel market with 11 downtown hotels, very vibrant convention business that's hosted the Super Bowl and Final Four and Comic-Con and the Champ Game. It's the only hotel in downtown or the region that actually reserves rooms specifically for hotel convention business.
Ultimately, is the city going to have to take a loss on this? How is the balance going to work out?
What's really important to understand is that when the hotel was developed, the money to build the hotel was raised from private lenders with a small portion of the debt guaranteed by hospitality taxes that were put in place years ago to help with downtown redevelopment. So, and some of those taxes were used during the recession to support the hotel, but the hotel now cash flows. So the interesting thing is that the hotel was supported partially by these taxes paid by visitors to Phoenix, not by local taxpayers. The revenue generated by the hotel's generated over $50 million in direct sales tax revenue since it was developed. All of that is going to support local services and activities. I think the city is now in a place where the hotel has stabilized, where the hotel is actually cash flowing, but it's in a place where, you know, it's aging. It needs $30 to $40 million in renovation. The city doesn't want to invest in that renovation, and when they can get the private sector to do that, so they're transitioning the hotel to private ownership with the understanding that the new owners would invest in the hotel and continue to keep the hotel as a first-rate property. I think the other thing is, you know, the city never really wanted to develop the hotel, but the market in Phoenix was perceived by the private sector to be so weak that the city was unable to do that.
People will say, you're offering property tax relief to this next private owner, and yet if the area is doing so well, why isn't the deal even better than that?
Steve, the one thing I would say, the hotel generates a lot of sales tax revenue. I mean, hotels pay over 12% in Phoenix and in sales tax locally into the state, but it pays zero property taxes since it's owned by the city. So in transitioning the property to the private sector, and in order to get the price that the city wants and to get the private sector to invest the $40 million in renovating the hotel, the city is offering a modified GPLAT No property, no abatement, but the property taxes are going to be reduced, but they're going to go from zero to almost $2 million a year in property tax revenue. So over the course of the GPLAT, there's going to be well over $50 million paid in excise taxes in lieu of property taxes. So really, what would have been property taxes, if the city continues to own the hotel, it's zero. So this is a great situation, I think, for particularly for the school district, since they get the lion's share of the money that comes from these GPLAT payments.
David Kreider is president of Downtown Phoenix, Inc.
Like fall in New York, there's a season it seems many Arizonans look forward to, monsoon season. But unlike the Big Apple, monsoon weather is unique to the Southwest, and you never quite know what it'll bring. For a series exploring personal relationships to the monsoon, producer Paige Phelps takes a tour of the Desert Botanical Garden with the director of horticulture, Brian Kissinger.
I'm Brian Kissinger. I'm the director of horticulture here at the Desert Botanical Garden. Those are cicadas, and they usually, you hear them in the garden a lot, especially just before the afternoon storms come in. All this ties together, weather with plants. We have to make a lot of decisions by the weather. At this time of the year, it's kind of like we're just getting off of what I call the hot winter effect. Like in other climates, winter, everything slows down, things go dormant. Really here with the heat, we have almost like a winter for our plants too. They go dormant, they sit there. Some of the plants burn, and they have to regenerate after that. So just like everything else, just like us, the rain comes along, and it's like, oh my God, we can breathe again. And the same thing with the plants. So I love this place up here for many reasons. There's little vignettes, and people can kind of see maybe a little spot, and they could do it home maybe. And I love these butterfly chairs because you can plop down in them, and you don't have to get up. You know, in the plains, it's like usually a front, cold front comes through. Here, it's that southerly flow blows up and the intensity of the humidity and everything comes together and creates a dust storm typically, and then a thunderstorm to follow. I think it's a really, really important deal. And it's important for people's psyche here as well. It's what it is, it's a process of the desert, but in the west and the southwest, it's an afternoon, you know, occurrence this time of year. The humidity levels go up and this, you know, storm comes in, and you always want to go outside after, or even in the middle of it, you know what I mean? You want to check it out, because it's that change. April, May, June, and then, okay, end of June, you're ready. You're ready for this change to happen, the seasonal change. And the plants are too, you know? The plants are stressed, and now it's like they realize, okay, I can grow again, you know? And some of the things that have bleached out, they can turn green again. They've got the supplies to bring the chlorophyll back. And then after it goes through, all the critters come out, all the washers are flowing. It's like, okay, life's here again. It can sustain itself again. My horticulture staff, we want the rain. We need to get, you know, we want to get 10 inches of rain this year. We have, you know, they go out and they do a rain dance. They do it. It's a big deal. It's a magic thing. In order to live here, you have to have protection. You have to create shade at your home. We have to create shade at the garden to grow the plants we want to grow. And we have to create shade for, you know, people that come through here. So exposure, you know, and all of that is a problem. So when the rains come, it's like, okay, life's coming back. You know, it's good for everything.
That was Brian Kissinger, director of horticulture at the Desert Botanical Garden.
From rock to hip-hop to country, concerts attract a huge variety of people from significantly different backgrounds. And sometimes the attendees are deaf. They still love the music, even if they're experiencing it in a less traditional way. But interpreting services are not always offered, and deaf people may need to request those services for specific concerts. Recently, I spoke with Valley resident Holly Hamilton about that. Her answers, expressed via sign language, were interpreted by Cameo Hunsaker. And it's Hunsaker's voice you'll hear answering my questions. Also, I refer to Holly Hamilton as deaf because that is the term she prefers. I started by asking Holly when she first knew that music was something she loved.
My father is a huge music guy. He really loves bands like Pearl Jam, U2. So I was raised around that quite a bit growing up.
So your dad's about my age then?
Yeah, actually about. I would say so. So I could listen to it with headphones. I could experience it. And I could read the words from, you know, like the liner notes. I could feel it, the vibrations. That was always a great sensation for me. You know, music helped me out through my life, just like it does for lots of people. Music was there through ups and downs and just all throughout my life. it just spoke to me. The kind of music that I typically listen to is rock. I'm a big Mumford & Sons fan. That's my favorite band. 21 Pilots is another of my favorites. So mostly in that rock alternative genre. I like a beat that you can feel, you know, something that's a little bit bassier, heavier, that I can feel in my chest.
Can you describe the experience, the difference of listening to music, let's say in your parents' home, which is a relatively quiet experience? Perhaps you can feel the vibrations and the music in a different way than it would attending a concert.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I feel like a concert. You know how you feel the energy, you feel everybody there singing the same songs together, and especially when there's an interpreter there who's interpreting along with the music, it gives me full access to everything that's going on. I can feel, you know, the lights, the energy. You can feel that sense of camaraderie, of community, that you feel that togetherness when you're at a concert all singing the same lyrics. I absolutely experience that. At home, you know, I would say that it's the same kind of thing. Obviously, you don't get that big sense of community, but you still have that experience from listening to the music. You know, it speaks to your soul. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I'm cleaning the house or doing work or whatever, I'll just, you know, throw my headphones on. It's definitely an important part of my life, just like for most of your listeners.
Are concert venues set up in a way so that people who are deaf can experience it the same way? Are there interpretive opportunities? Do you think venues are aware that there are people who are deaf who want to attend concerts and experience the same thing, but maybe need some sort of other aspects to it so that they can really experience the concert?
Well, that is a pretty loaded question, to tell you the truth. A lot of the venues will provide interpreters. They will. That's been my experience. They'll provide, you know, lighting for the interpreters. They'll provide proper placements. However, not without a fight. Mm-hmm. Many other venues, you have to fight quite a bit in order to get the services that you need to enjoy, to have access to a concert like that. It actually starts when you first contact the venue to set up the interpreting services. Typically, there isn't an easy way to do that. Maybe you'll contact the guest service department or send them an email or give them a call. Oftentimes, though, you get the runaround. They'll say, oh, you know, you need to contact this department or this manager. No one really ever knows who is responsible for setting that up. It can be a very lengthy, time-consuming runaround.
Any signs that this is getting better? Is this a lack of education?
That is also another loaded question. I think in general, it is a service that deaf people need. I think that people assume that all accessible seats or handicapped access is going to be for people in wheelchairs. So what often happens is a venue will stick a deaf person and an interpreter in a wheelchair accessible place, but that is not, we don't have the same disability and the access is different. The barrier to access for us is hearing. It's the sound and the doorway to access is going to be visually. What we need is closer access to the stage, not necessarily in the front, but closer. We need to be able to visually be able to have access to the stage, to the performers on stage, the same line of sight between the performers and the interpreters. When we're put back in those handicap areas, we don't always get the proper lighting. Whenever you're in the front, you can usually depend on the show lights. We need to be able to see the interpreters, obviously, in order to get that access. We also need to be able to see the performers. We want to see their facial expressions. What you can hear, you know, their emotion. You can hear who is being featured on the stage as far as who is speaking, who is singing, who is having their solo. That's something that we visually see. When we're stuck back, all the way in the nosebleeds, that's not something that we have access to, and that makes it lesser of an experience than the hearing people there.
Are there some interpreters that for a particular concert are just a better fit?
Honestly, you know, in my experience, I'm not sure. Now, I've experienced quite a few different interpreters, and some, you know, maybe aren't quite as expressive. I really prefer interpreters who are incredibly expressive, who really I can experience the concert through their facial expression and through their beautiful signs. There are certain interpreters that I will request to work with and that just give me a better window into the experience that the hearing people are having, mm-hmm. for sure. Part of their entire job is to match the emotion that is coming out from the performers on stage. And certain interpreters are better at that than others.
That conversation was with Holly Hamilton, who is deaf. Her sign language answers were interpreted by Cameo Hunsaker.
New findings from a report by the ACLU of Arizona shows minority students here are punished more often than their white counterparts and are much more likely to be suspended from school. African-American students are 8 times more likely to be suspended from certain schools than white students, and Native American students are 10 times more likely, according to the report. And here to talk with us more about this is Alessandra Soler, Executive Director of the ACLU of Arizona. Alessandra, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So what was the motivation for doing this study? Was there a sense that there was something problematic going on here?
Yeah, several years ago, we started getting calls from parents, from moms of kids with special needs and moms of students of color. And they were calling because their kids were being suspended and expelled for minor offenses. And so, things like it was either behavioral issues or, dress code violations, not having a belt or having, a hairstyle that wasn't approved by the school. And so we then started, looking into it and went to data that's publicly available. Really the only data that's publicly available through the Office of Civil Rights and the federal government, Department of Ed. And then that's how we got to where we are today. I mean, the data was just astonishing, and it really confirmed what we've been hearing from the parents all along, that the kids are being, African-American kids, Latino kids, Native American kids are being disproportionately targeted, and some of the worst offenders are the kind of well-known high-performing charter schools. And like that study that you, the numbers that you quoted, the African-American students, this is in charter high schools, are 8 times more likely than their white peers to receive out-of-school suspension. So the racial disparities were just very, very significant.
Did you also look at traditional district schools in addition to charter schools? And did you include private schools as well?
We did. We only looked at public schools. So we looked at charter schools and district schools. And yes, I mean, in some categories, the district schools, the numbers in the district schools were also very troubling, particularly the district schools in neighboring tribal communities. That's where we had Native American students who were up to 10 times more likely than their white peers to be suspended. And when it came to students with disabilities in elementary and middle schools, both district schools and charter schools, they were twice as likely to be suspended. And so, this is obviously a major, major, very disturbing problem that is impacting schools across the board. And, our goal with this campaign is to really try to keep it as many kids as possible in schools and try to end these disturbing exclusionary practices that are pushing kids out.
What have you heard from school district and school officials about this?
It's a great question. What I'm most proud of is that, we have spent the last, year doing the analysis. And then what we've done is just shared the information with the schools. We've gone to the schools themselves, some of the worst offenders, and said, we went to schools in diverse neighborhoods and said, hey, here's the data. There have been some schools, that have voluntarily joined the coalition and said, we recognize there's a problem. And, these are both charter schools and district schools. Obviously, not all schools are with us, but we have, as part of the launch yesterday, we got commitment from 8 different schools who are going to be working to develop model policies to kind of reduce their numbers. And so, and this is some big school districts, in terms of the charters, Phoenix Collegiate Academy, ASA, Vista College Prep, Academia del Pueblo, those are the charter schools that have voluntarily joined the coalition and are committing to address this issue. And some big districts are like Pendergrass, Phoenix Union, Vault. Those are the school districts that have joined the coalition. Now we recognize, not everyone, obviously some of the big players, Great Hearts which was also, they had very, very disturbing numbers. Legacy, Leona Group, some of these big, large charters have not voluntarily participated, but we're going to continue the conversations with them and to try to see if they're interested in addressing the issue.
Alessandro, very quickly before we let you go, how did you find the numbers in schools where the student body was more diverse versus schools that were predominantly maybe one racial group or ethnic group over another?
Well, I mean, Mesa is a large system, very diverse system. They have very, very high numbers of suspensions and expulsions of students of color. And so
You know, that's the one example. And, you know, there was a, we had our launch yesterday, over 200 people were there, and we had some school board members from Mesa and some Native American parents whose kids are in the Mesa School District. And so we're hoping, you know, to continue the conversation with them so that, you know, they can begin to address this.
Alessandra Soler is executive director of the ACLU of Arizona. Alessandra, thanks a lot.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having me.